about big decisions like seeking out higher education, starting a business or a nonprofit, buying a house or saving for retirement, the common denominator is hope. A sense of despair not only assumes things will go from bad to worse, it also kills any motivation to try for better. We know a certain amount of optimism matters for our individual well-being. It may also be essential to our families, our communities, even our national security. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. If we can agree hope is not a luxury, but a necessity for a good and productive life, my guest thinks it's worth understanding the way that history and culture and life circumstances affect how hopeful we feel, and worth exploring how public policy can build or chip away at our vision of a brighter future. Carol Graham is interim vice president and director of economic studies at the Brookings Institution and College Park professor at the University of Maryland. Her new book is called The Power of Hope: How the Science of Well-Being Can Save Us from Despair. Carol, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. I'm happy to be on.
People might not think about economists studying something like hope. How do you define hope in your work?
Well, there is no sort of set definition across all social science and medical science disciplines, but I would say the one thing that really stands about hope from other measures of well-being is it's both future-oriented and it requires agency. In other words, it isn't just the belief that things will get better, which is optimism, and people, you know, that's a good trait to have, but hope is the belief that you can make things better. And so it actually, it affects people's investments in their future, their behaviors much more directly. In the book, I talk about the tragic optimist versus the hopeful pessimist, and they are distinct. The optimist who thinks things will always get better but doesn't really do much about it versus somebody who knows things are not really good, but they want to make them better. And so I think that is why hope, which is, as you say, seems to be a mushy concept that an economist should not be working on, is actually really important to people's future outcomes because it really affects their behavior towards the future, their investments in the future, their avoidance of risky behaviors that will jeopardize their futures.
How does a hopeful person tend to behave in ways that will be beneficial in the long run?
So, you know, there are many ways to think of them, but an example, which is in both chapters 3 and 4 of my book is how young adults make choices which affect their futures in a you know, major way. And how if they have aspirations and hope, and the two are linked concepts, hope is a more general overarching concept and aspirations are more focused on a goal. So if they have aspirations for, say, higher education or graduate school, and these are poor young adults that I interviewed, they're not, you know, some are in Peru, some are in low-income neighborhoods in Missouri, in the U.S. So if they believe in their futures, if they are hopeful and they have targeted aspirations, they actually make investments in those hopes and aspirations. And what we found when we were able to follow the kids that we interviewed over time was that the ones that had the highest levels of hope and aspirations were still trying to achieve them 3 years later. They were making progress, right? They wanted to go to either college or high school. And this is in low-income Peru, so it's pretty amazing. And a very large percent of our respondents had those hopes and aspirations, in part because they have mentors in their family or their community and their mentors have often not gone to college, but they want them to do better. And in part, you know, Peru although it's a poor country, values education. Really interestingly, in the U.S., we now have very mixed, among deprived people, we have very mixed views about whether education matters. And so I found that my low-income white respondents were much less likely to want to go on to higher education after high school, and their parents did not support them going to college, versus the African-American and Hispanic respondents, even though they were more materially deprived, were trying to do exactly that. They were trying to get a higher education. They wanted to do that to make things better. And there's the distinction, I think, or an example of the distinction, you know, between how hope can result in aspirations and better outcomes, and not having hope can preclude investments in making your outcomes better.
Yeah, lots of Americans might point to persistent economic inequality as a reason to lack hope. And here is where you've alluded to this. Things start to get complicated and frankly interesting. What have studies revealed about the broad distribution of hope across more and less privileged populations in the United States?
Yeah, that is, as you say, both complicated and interesting, and both, you know, positive and at the same time not positive at all, quite frightening. So what we see is the more deprived populations, African Americans and Hispanics, but low-income African Americans in particular, have the highest levels of hope of any low-income group. And that is a persistent finding. It's not driven by, say, a particular event. It's not driven by Obama's presidency. It's not driven by, you know, it didn't drop during Trump's presidency. It didn't even drop during COVID, which was obviously hit low-income minorities much harder than other groups. And yet they retain their hope for the future. Now, those same respondents can say the city that they live in is not a good place. They can say there's a lot of crime. They can say their financial situation is bad. Again, they are not the tragic optimists. They really are. They recognize their situation, but they want to make it better. And that becomes also supported in the collective. There's a contagion effect, in a way, a good contagion effect, where if you have backing in a community that also shares hopes and aspirations for you, and the community can be your family, it can be your church, it can be, you know, whatever. For Hispanics, it tends to be extended families. I'm from Peru. Everybody's your aunt, uncle, even if they're not. For African Americans, it tends to be Baptist churches and the community around them. Low-income whites have typically had a more sort of small family social network. In other words, sort of the not extended families, not extended communities, but kind of the working family. And for a long time, they had, you know, they went to high school, graduated, worked in good working class jobs. They had privileged access to those jobs. But when that fell apart with the decline in manufacturing and other blue collar work, which is only getting worse over time, the communities, the families fell apart. A lot less marriage rates have dropped. Divorce rates are way up. And they saw themselves as in decline, both relative to minorities who were making progress. So minorities typically are more deprived and more discriminated against. But if you look at gaps in education, in marriage rates, and other things, they're much more determined now by income than by race. So that they also, the white working class, also fell way behind wealthy whites. You talked about income inequality. It's a big issue, right? So the people that they might compare themselves to are so far from what they see and know and how they live. They were falling behind in many ways. And the other thing that I think has resulted in their fallen hope is the very, the very American dream myth, which I think whites are much more likely to believe than minorities who face more discrimination, more barriers. And so, you know, the work, you work hard, you get ahead. You know, if you fall behind, you're poor in America. That narrative is now what's happening to them. They're falling behind and they're poor. And it isn't their fault, right? But so there's sort of many different factors that have led to a real contrast between typically hopeful and resilient minorities and poor whites who used to have an advantage and have lost it. And relative decline from everything we know, you know, relative status decline is something that's really difficult to deal with and get over. And so is very complicated. And then you throw in opioids and no jobs and lots of other things, and you have sort of a perfect storm. And it was linked to death and despair and other things.
How does a lack of hope affect people's interest in, say, moving somewhere else in the country in search of better opportunities?
So, one of the things I found in one study that was striking, and it was studying prime age males who've dropped out of the labor force. They're not in good shape in the sense that they tend to have depression, they tend to have addiction and other problems related to opioids, which the opioid suppliers and manufacturers targeted low-income white declining communities actually specifically. And in a weird but protective way, minorities were less likely to be prescribed medicine for pain, right? So that actually was a protective thing, as horrible as, you know, the reason for it is. So this vicious circle of, you know, addiction, lack of good jobs, lack of community has resulted in, or, you know, has certainly, I would say, destroyed any kinds of hopes and aspirations that these people have. And one of the things that they're sort of hidden. We don't know about these people. Even though almost 20% of prime age males were out of the labor force, that means permanently dropped out of the labor force, before COVID, this is not a COVID thing, when we were boasting record numbers of record low unemployment and, you know, booming stock markets and all kinds of things, they aren't counted in the unemployment ratio. So if you have not looked for a job in the past 6 months, you fall out of the numerator in the unemployment ratio. So the denominator is divided in a smaller group of people, but all these people have dropped out. So they aren't even reflected in our standard unemployment rate. You have to look at a different rate to pick them up. So when I look more closely into their well-being or ill-being, so to speak, I know, you know, they have very, as I mentioned, they have high levels of addiction. They have low levels of hope, low levels of life satisfaction. But also, they were much more likely, and particularly the white prime age males out of the labor force, were much more likely to either be living in their parents' census tract or their parents' homes as adults than any other labor force group. And when you look at minority prime age males out of the labor force, they tend to at least want to give back to their community. They are actually more hopeful than prime age white males out of the labor force. So they're sort of the group that reflects the decline of the white working class the most.
My guest, Carol Graham, is author of The Power of Hope, How the Science of Well-Being Can Save Us from Despair. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Carol, how would despair among working class white people play into far-right radicalization?
Well, there's actually a frightening link, which we're starting to document a little better, between being in despair and being vulnerable to misinformation and radicalization, particularly right-wing radicalization. I think particularly right-wing radicalization because it's targeted at white communities in despair or in decline. So if you think about the definition of despair is not exactly the opposite of hope, but pretty close. Despair is kind of a state where you don't really care if you live or die. You have no purpose or meaning in life, right? You don't have an anchor. I mean, so when you think about prime age men living in their parents' basement without a job and without a sense of purpose, they're a prime candidate, right? And they spend a lot of time, in addition, on social media. They often live in communities that don't have good access to local news sources like the Think program or, you know, the Baltimore Sun, where my own son writes. And so this combination of lack of access to education opportunities, job opportunities, credible local news, and being yourself in despair, having no hope for the future, it makes you very vulnerable to kind of whatever comes up, right? And if they're, you read things that are promising you that things will get better, or that it's all the fault of immigrants, or it's all the fault of minorities who are getting all the government benefits and attention, even though we know that isn't true, you're much more likely to fall into that trap. And so we are actually documenting how places that have this combination of factors are also places that are more vulnerable to despair. So it isn't just individuals, but actually entire communities.
So Carol, optimism and resilience are clearly deeply shaped by culture. What might inspire the kind of optimism and resilience among Black Americans that is not present at the same level in white Americans with about the same amount of money?
Or even if Black Americans have less money, because they typically are more. For example, in the surveys I did, the low-income white respondents were more likely to own their own homes than the Black respondents, as an example, right? But it is a cultural trait. It's not only a cultural trait, but I think it's this collective belief that you have to keep going and make things better. It is resilience. It's I think part of it is just generated over a long period of time of overcoming adversity and sharing that challenge, sharing both the challenges, but the small victories, big victories. It's kind of more of a shared community identity. And so and Hispanics have it as well. I'm from Latin America. There's just very strong sense of kind of community family, not well defined, but of kind of a collective that really isn't part of the standard American dream. Kind of, I don't want to say myth, although it's becoming a myth, the kind of narrative, right? Which is much more about individual work ethic. And instead, these communities that minorities have also provide empathy. I call them often communities of empathy because collectively you've been overcoming adversity, because you probably have a sister or a brother or an uncle or someone who's fallen behind for just or unjust reasons, often unjust reasons. You have empathy for people who fall behind, and then you know you're much more likely to support them. And people who fall behind do not feel they're losers, right? It's a lot easier to pick yourself up and keep going if you don't feel stigmatized as, a loser, essentially. And I think it's just really that same narrative does not exist among low-income whites. And so what we're starting to see is that the narratives which blame others, for their decline are, increasingly popular, particularly among groups who are in despair, who are really falling behind in a permanent way. And it's exacerbated by this now erosion of faith in higher education, because in tomorrow's labor markets, right, there aren't going to be more blue-collar jobs. There are going to be less. And the kinds of skills that you need to survive in tomorrow's labor markets as a, young person entering the labor market are things like socio-emotional and cognitive skills, programming techniques, whatever. They aren't the skills you learn in public high school. So they need to invest in some sort of education. It doesn't have to be college. And yet there's no narrative for how to do that. There's very little mentorship, at least among the white kids that I interviewed, versus the minority kids tended to have somebody in their community or in their family who supported their hopes and aspirations.
You note that one reality that feeds despair in this country is that the costs of failure are really high, which is to say, like, losing a job usually means losing health insurance, possibly stable housing. We haven't set up a strong safety net for people who are experiencing tough times, right?
We haven't. I mean, we often boast that we spent more money than any other country on kind of COVID safety nets for people, child tax credits or whatever, a range of things. But one reason we spent more money is our existing safety net is so weak, right? So we had to spend money. And it helped. It helped people not fall into poverty. In fact, it reduced temporarily the poverty rate. But yeah, our safety nets are very fragmented. They vary a lot by state. There are certain programs that work very well that are, they tend to be universal programs. The Earned Income Tax Credit is a targeted program that works very well. And one reason is it is not stigmatizing, right? So if you're below a certain income and you're working, you get sort of a bump up in your earnings that's just mailed to you as a tax credit, right? You don't have to go wait in an office and for 10 hours and be, you know, mistreated or whatever. Versus if you are on TANF, which is cash assistance for needy families, you're typically a single mother. You know, things are not easy. For example, your kid is in daycare and gets sick, and you work in a low-quality job, of which there are many, and you miss a week because you're staying home taking care of the sick kid, often you'll lose your job. And so then kind of it goes into a negative spiral, right, of not being able to climb out. And the idea that, you know, one, a lot of workers don't have good benefits. A lot of workers don't get health insurance in these low-quality jobs. But even if you're in a job with health insurance but you lose your job, you fall into a negative spiral. And in this country, losing your health insurance is a big deal. I mean, health care can be some of the best in the world. It's also some of the most expensive in the world. And we have a lot of people who don't get health care because they can't afford it. And mental health care is even worse. Access to mental health care is even lower, and it's very expensive, and it's pretty much missing in a lot of places. I mean, rural Texas is a great example.
Why would despair be linked to risk-taking behaviors?
Well, for a little bit the same reason when I was talking about how hope affects future outcomes, and one channel is via investments in your own future, right? If you want to do better in the future, you realize, and you're going to do something about getting there, you realize there's certain things you have to do. Often it entails educating yourself. Now, if you take, you know, serious drugs, or you other risky behaviors, which could make you sick or which could put you in prison, you're jeopardizing your future. That's kind of pretty straightforward. But if you don't care, if you don't really believe you have a future, right, what do you have to lose, so to speak? Mm-hmm. Even though we know you objectively have a lot to lose if you harm your health or end up in jail, but it's a condition that's hard to imagine if you're not in it. But if you are, you can see why prime-age males out of the labor force who don't have a future are not going to pick up and move to where the jobs are, right? Because they don't have the motivation or the aspirations to do so. They don't think it will work, and it will likely be difficult. So it's kind of a vicious circle, and I think the risky behavior element of it, which often manifests itself in drug addiction, is one of the most negative reinforcing channels.
So culture and environment have very strong effects on our orientation toward the future. Is there anything possibly biological at play here? Are there genetic components to our kind of baseline hope state?
There are definitely genetic components to our underlying well-being, and which includes hope. And those are, there's kind of a gene transmitter it's one of the genes that transmits serotonin, which is very much linked to higher levels of well-being. And if you get two long alleles of that gene as opposed to just one, that's a good thing, right? You're going to have more serotonin. And if you look at the genetic and cultural distribution of that gene, because the genes are often shared, some elements of genes are shared across cultures, you see that minorities actually have higher levels of that gene transmitter than whites. So it's kind of, that's amazing. It's very novel work. We don't We don't know that much about it. But we do know, and it's very much like the debate on what determines IQ, right? And there used to be vociferous debates about was it genes or was it the environment? And then we realized, and this kind of came to some consensus, that over time, your genes interact with your environment, right? So in the case of IQ, it's your cognitive skill genes that interact with the environment you are in, the kind of education you're getting, the, you know, the signals you're getting that can affect your confidence, it can, you know, can all sorts of things, right? And so well-being is very similar. So about 30% or between 30 and 40% of our existing levels of well-being, which could be life satisfaction, it could be, you know, positive and negative affect, it could be hope. These are all sort of traits which are malleable over time. In fact, later into the life cycle than IQ, which really after about age 30, your IQ levels don't change much, but your emotional wisdom sure can. But in any event, they also interact with the kind of environment that you are in. So if you live in a culture or in a context, a community, where there's shared hope and where if you fall behind, there's support. If you're a kid trying to think what you're going to do in the future, there's somebody that says, you can do it, you can do better. And maybe guides you a little bit on how, because there's no way that most, you know, 18-year-olds know what to do about tomorrow's labor markets, right? And then that contributes to a cultivation of hope. Versus if you're in a community in despair where the majority of people are addicted, taking risky behaviors, or worse, committing suicide. And that's the reality in a lot of deprived communities. I mean, we have a crisis of deaths of despair in this country, right? If that's your environment, it's pretty hard to be hopeful as an individual, right? So there's sort of a combination of environment and genetics and all sorts of things, and you know that, and individual experiences that can make a difference in this complex sort of determining cycle. But what we know is that having hope also helps you get through a negative cycle versus giving up and falling even deeper into despair. So, and we know a bit about, we're not, you know, this is again new territory, but we know a bit about interventions that can practically help people, whether it's educating kids in school about things like self-esteem and resilience and all sorts of, you know, skills that often, particularly kids who grew up in adversity, don't acquire at home. And then, you know, for older people, it tends to be just getting them out of isolation, getting them back into the community. It could be volunteering, it could be access to the arts. But a combination of social interaction and a restoration of some sort of meaning and purpose in their existence really matters to restoring some sense of hope and to reducing despair. And as I mentioned, for young people who are entering the labor force in a very uncertain climate and time, they need mentorship, right? They need somebody that supports them in their aspirations, but that also helps them decide what's the best thing that they can do given their, you know, financial situations, given the opportunities around them, whatever it might be.
Carol, hope looks like a really adaptive trait. Are there any downsides, though, to being able to experience hope even when living conditions are really bad? Like, can a positive outlook make us complacent about conditions we would be better off challenging?
I have thought a lot about that, and I've also actually done some research into it, because that's sort of the first thought you have, right? When you see people who are living in tough conditions are hopeful, and you think, oh, they've just adapted to how difficult they are. And I've done a fair amount of work on adaptation because it is a psychological coping mechanism. You know, adapting to bad things that you're stuck with is probably better than, you know, being miserable about them, right? But my hopeful respondents are not complacent. They're more likely than the less hopeful ones, and there's also the racial differences as well, to say they're financial situation is bad. You know, their community is dangerous, but they care about their community and they want to make it better. They're on the health front, it's a little more complicated because minorities typically don't get as good health care and their health conditions tend to be worse, although they are gradually making some progress. But I think because of that, there's sort of the sort of intervening channel of provision of less good health care, which I'm not sure that people adapt to that, but that's often what they're stuck with. But in any event, if you think about that tragic optimist versus hopeful pessimist distinction I made, they're much more likely to be hopeful pessimists than they are tragic optimists, right? They're realistic about what their you know, the obstacles are and what's bad in their lives, but they want it to be better, and they want their children to do better than they are, right? And that's something that has sort of changed for low-income whites. There really isn't a belief that things will be better for their children than it is for them. Most people think their children will live worse than they.
How does hope or the lack of it affect our experience of stress in daily life?
So stress is a marker of ill-being, and it's linked to bad health outcomes like heart conditions and other things. And it turns out that the same respondents who report high levels of hope also report lower levels of stress, given the same challenges that less hopeful people have, and they report much higher levels of stress. And so it's sort of a channel by which being hopeful actually helps you navigate challenges to both objective health and mental health.
Carol, you've talked about studies of populations all over the country and all over the world. What does it take to accurately measure hope across different cultures, different ages, different times?
Right. Well, that's a good question, and it's a good trick. And here, what we use are pretty complicated econometric equations. So one thing about well-being is well-being research and the science of well-being measurement is, and probably the most important thing to remember about it, so I don't need to go into the details of the equations, is that we are not asking people what makes them hopeful or what makes them happy or what makes them stressed or what makes them angry, any whatever measure you're trying to explore. We have people's reported stress levels, anger levels, levels of hope, life satisfaction, and then we control for their income, education, employment, marital status, all sorts of things. And then we look at conditions that vary more that may affect hopefulness or stress, things like particular health conditions or income inequality or bad environmental quality. And we can then see how those things may or may not affect people's well-being reports. And to try and control for cultural differences, what we do is something called, we control for, say, country dummies or county dummies. And what those things are that you collect for all of the people that are in the same country or the same region or the same county, depends what level of aggregation you're interested in. You are able to control for the shared bias, which could be positive or it could be negative, but the shared kind of unexplained thing that seems to be determining answers in those places only. And so by doing that, you're able to compare people who live in different countries and may, for example, could be response bias, right? You know, some people just speak more cheerfully. Some people have sunnier dispositions than others. And those are often shared across, you know, cultures and regions. And so we try and control for things like response bias. We also certainly control for time. So if you've done a survey 2 decades ago versus a survey now, you need to adjust for that time difference. And so we can basically control for almost anything. Even when we have the same data on individuals over time, we're actually able to control for individual character traits that are not explained by our observable variables like income, health, and all these other things, but are just you know, individual differences, some of which could be biological, as we talked about before. And then you can explore the outcome variable that you're interested in, and not just and be more sure. You're never completely sure, but be more sure that it isn't being driven by individual, unobservable individual traits.
Do our levels of hope tend to change in predictable ways over the course of a lifetime? Like, are younger people with their whole lives ahead of them apt to be more hopeful than older ones?
Typically, and it kind of makes intuitive sense, right? So actually, older people increase their life satisfaction over time, particularly after the middle life years, when it actually there's a pretty universal drop across countries, people, countries, populations, cultures. It varies a little bit, but not a lot. So sort of the middle age years tend to be the least happy period in people's lives. Makes sense. Double financial burdens, time burdens, teenagers, older parents, aspirations aligning with reality. When, you know, if you don't play guitar and sing, by the time you're 50, maybe you should give up on being a rock star, right? I love that analogy, because it is kind of, it's painful, but you finally get over it, right? But hope, obviously, you know, if you're looking forward to a whole life versus you are 60, it seems to be kind of, you would think it's totally different. And there are some differences, but there are also some really interesting stand-ups, like African-Americans are our most hopeful group, right? In the U.S., in terms of racial group, they maintain their hope levels well into old age, much later into old age than other groups. I can't fully explain that finding, but it seems to me to fit this pattern of persistent resilience and hope that doesn't seem to be that much affected by events or, you know, political events or whatever it might be. It's very much a kind of persistent hope and resilience that probably has helped keep African Americans going and continuing to progress, you know, even though times are hard. I mean, one of the things that struck me was there was during the George, I was looking at more detailed overtime data during COVID, and obviously was pretty amazed that African Americans retain their hope levels during COVID. But when I looked at the George Floyd period in particular, which was very tumultuous, what I found were increases in stress levels among African Americans, but the hope levels remained high. So, you know, that's another example of how there's some part of that trait really seems to stem from resilience to adversity and sort of determination to overcome it.
Obviously, the point of doing this sort of research is not just to survey who has hope and who doesn't, but to see whether it is possible to restore hope to populations that have lost it. What have you learned about this?
Well, as I mentioned, it's a new discipline. It's certainly a new concept for economists to be thinking about emotions driving behavior and changing traits, or are traits malleable? But there is some work. As I mentioned, we know that these traits like hope are much more malleable later into the life cycle than IQ. So they're much more, they can be formed more, cultivated more by different experiences. Even among young people, teaching certain skills can help support those traits develop. And so, you know, as I mentioned, we have interventions in schools, particularly in the UK, that try and teach self-esteem, resilience, coping skills in middle and high schools. And they evaluate the students, you know, over time during the course of that curriculum. These are in deprived parts of the US, UK, the Greater Manchester region, which is in a big deindustrializing region. And they find that their interventions in the schools not only increase well-being, but they increase school performance. So I think, you know, that's an example of the kind of thing we can do. When you think about declining communities where there are a lot of isolated people, often elderly people, are not going to go back to work, and nor are the jobs going to come back. I think if you can, one of the things you need to do is restore community pride, right? That there's restore the sense of collective. And then often it's engaging people in community activities that give them purpose. Volunteering is a great example and one of the best, because all of a sudden you have people who are in despair, or were in despair, gaining meaning and purpose in their life through helping others. And I think that's a really powerful channel. I have a colleague at Brookings, Tony Pipa, who's done some wonderful work on reimagining rural communities. And often bringing a sort of reviving an industry in the communities, often tourism or something that sort of produces community pride and involves some collective activity, can make a big difference to restoring hope in the community. And then there, as I said, there are spillovers between individual and collective hope and well-being. And certainly, you know, the sense that you live in a community that's in decline is pretty hard to remain hopeful in that context. But if you're in a place that's reviving and that's trying to get better, and you sort of are at the same time cultivating pride in your community, that can make a difference. And then obviously it's a lot more hope. It's a lot easier to be hopeful if you're getting educated, if you're learning the skills that you need to do well in the labor market and in life. And often, as I said, those are not the typical skills that we have in our school curriculums, where test taking and learning facts and learning algebra, all of which are very important, but we're often not, you know, we're not that good at teaching the skills that people need to navigate an increasingly complex world. And the other thing I've been working on quite a bit, in addition to misinformation and despair, is sort of the potential effects of AI on all sorts of jobs. And, you know, AI has some amazing potential. It's also got some pretty daunting dangers, particularly for people who don't have high skills and higher levels of education.
Carol, what can public policy do potentially to address the presence of despair in our society and build hope?
Again, we're talking about an uncharted area, but there are examples, and we need to learn from them. In the UK, it's been a much more the whole concept of well-being is now really built into their statistics gathering, their budgetary policy, their priorities set for like their leveling up effort, which is an effort designed to decrease disparity across regions in the UK, because like the US, they're very divided between sort of dying industrialized regions and London and the kind of, you know, thriving high skill areas. But what's interesting is for leveling up, even though they're interested in reducing inequality of income and opportunity, a stated priority is reducing inequality of well-being, because we find that people with lower levels of well-being are less productive. They don't live as long. There are all kinds of things and reasons for why, like psychiatrists say, restoring hope is the first step. There are all kinds of reasons why restoring well-being really matters to positive outcomes. In the U.S., we have some local efforts, but we don't have as much at the centralized level. There's one very positive trait is that we have some emphasis at the federal level on mental health and the importance of dealing with poor mental health and trying to support good mental health. That's a stated objective of the current administration. And then the Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy, is very involved in an initiative to combat loneliness. And everything we know about loneliness is it's a precursor to depression, even to suicide, not causally, but it's very much associated with it. And when we think about the kinds of people in despair that I've spoken about, loneliness is a big factor, right? Particularly older people, but even now younger people. So I think we need to think about expanding mental health treatment, and particularly in places where it is very scarce and very lacking. like, you know, rural, a lot of parts of the rural United States. And we need to think beyond the kind of patient doctor individual treatment, because we don't have the resources. It doesn't exist in a lot of the country, but we do have many ways to deliver mental health care, new ways. Telehealth has turned out to be a really positive thing in making mental health much more accessible to many more people. We have new involvement in communities, in peers, in encouraging people in their community to get mental health treatment and sort of connecting potential patients and treatment. And along with, you know, the kinds of interventions I've talked about that restore community pride, community well-being, or that provide necessary training for kids and adolescents to sort of develop the skills that they need in addition to, you know, typical academic skills to sort of thrive in tomorrow's labor markets. Because we've also seen that not being able to work is one of the most deleterious things for well-being. And that people who are out of the labor force, who dropped out of the labor force, are often in really bad, end up in bad shape, in addiction, suicide, all sorts of things. But it also, you don't really know in completely which direction the causality is, right? Maybe they wanted to work and then they couldn't find a job and eventually they got discouraged and dropped out, right?
Carol Graham is Interim Vice President and Director of Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution and College Park Professor at the University of Maryland. Her book is called The Power of Hope: How the Science of Well-Being Can Save Us from Despair. Carol, thanks for the conversation.
Chris, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on.
Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.